independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and joining me today is Hale. You are listening to our Reading the Pre-Socratics series. This is episode 6. On our previous episode, we discussed Pherecydes and Xenophanes, both innovating and then later on critical theologians or thinkers of popular religion at the time. But now we are moving into more philosophical and strictly philosophical and sort of pre-metaphysical territory now. We are going to be discussing in this episode Heraclitus. Now, this is a really exciting moment for our series and for pre-Socratic philosophy in general, because Heraclitus is really the first pre-Socratic who we have a large number of, not just testimonia. So when we're doing pre-Socratic philosophy, we do have to pay attention to, are we reading fragments? Are we reading direct quotations that people are saying, Xenophanes said this, or Heraclitus said this, or are we getting secondhand accounts or anecdotes about the deeds and character of these people? With Heraclitus, we get a slew of direct quotations, or people who are quoting Heraclitus. Oftentimes people are either misremembering, or they are just, because there's some deviations and differences in the quotations. But in any case, we have people claiming to quote Heraclitus and his text or remember his text. So this is a very exciting moment in pre-Socratic philosophy where we start getting large texts, practically a corpus to work with. We really can read across these fragments. Now, what's also really interesting and kind of fortunate about Heraclitus and his work in particular is that you may be thinking, okay, well, we've got all these fragments, that's great, but they're just little snippets. What are we supposed to do with these? It seems as though that Heraclitus intended for his writing to take this form. When you read the style of these fragments, you can tell that they are written to be self-contained, to be aphoristic in this sense. There's some longer prose sections as well, which is really interesting. And some people have actually thought that that indicates that Heraclitus wasn't writing aphorisms. But you can clearly tell just reading the wit behind these fragments that we're actually dealing with something in a form that is quite close to what they would have resembled. Now, of course, we don't have them in their arrangement, because the other thing is we've been picking these up just like we've been picking up the rest of our fragments. Quotations here and there scattered across the entire ancient Greek corpus. We've had scholars collect them and gather them together, so we don't have them in order at all. But what's really interesting is that we can read different kinds of allusions and references and resonances between these. The work doesn't survive, but we have a large chunk of it, and we can surmise the meaning of a full work from this. We can get a whole metaphysical system out of this. And we get this later on with other thinkers as well. When we get into Parmenides, we have significant full extent sections as well, which will be really exciting to read. That is a little bit about the text itself that we're reading. Heraclitus himself is coming at an interesting time in pre-Socratic philosophy as well. We actually get him commenting by name on other thinkers as well. So previously we were talking about Pythagoras and Xenophanes and Hesiod. He calls them out for explicit critique. So he is coming a bit later into the philosophical activity, as it were. And he has a chance to respond to these people. So he's going to be critically responding, not just to the popular notions at the time, but also to other thinkers as well. So that's very interesting to see.
There's actually so much interesting that's going on with him. I know, as you already pointed out for our listeners, emphasize, like, Brandon and I were both getting very excited about getting into Heraclitus, because he really is a giant leap forward in this kind of pre-Socratic story we're doing. One of the interesting things that he's doing, not just in terms of the content, but also in terms of the intentionality and the structure of his philosophy. Is one, there's these explicit critiques, there's these kind of like pseudo arguments or shutdowns of other thinkers, which is something that's like quite revolutionary, like philosophy as like picking apart this guy's ideas, you know, saying why this guy is like incorrect and ostensibly like my picture is like more is better. But also too, with that, that kind of hints at the fact that Heraclitus, more than any other thinker we've covered so far really at all, seems to be trying to evoke a certain kind of thought and pattern in the reader, rather than just like displaying, rather than just being putting out there like some of the other, like Xenophanes or Anaximander or whoever who we read previously, basically just being like, I think reality is like X, right? Like here's my postulation. It seems that Heraclitus is much more interested in evoking a certain kind of thinking in the reader, evoking a kind of conversation with the reader, sometimes antagonistic, but there's quite obviously a lot more depth going on in Heraclitus's work than anyone previously we've covered.
Yeah, absolutely. There is this awareness with Heraclitus that writing is writing for someone, and it, like with the case with Xenophanes can say, okay, well, we don't know, there are things to be known, but we can't really know them, but we can improve our search. He kind of just puts it on the table. But with Heraclitus, there's a certain relationship to the truth that he has that he's trying to share with the reader. He knows the truth, but he can't just come out and expose it and say, hey, here's the truth. He understands that the truth reveals itself under certain conditions. And the fact that when he says these things, he's saying them with an oral or oracular sort of fashion or style to it. I mean, I should just say it immediately too, like that's one of the first things that strikes you about Heraclitus' writing is that you know you're dealing with a stylist. You know you're dealing with someone who is not, he's coming maybe an intellectual generation later than the Milesians, but he's seen prose work and he knows what prose work looks like. And he knows that it can be done well or poorly, and he's decided to do it a certain way. He's decided to hint at or make allusions to things or use metaphors or to mean something in one place of his text and then evoke that meaning indirectly at another to hint at constructing relations between the text within itself. Indicating, as he says, we'll get to that fragment as well, that's very interesting, but it is interesting that the difficulty with this is, and it's been the kind of, this is the main thing that people understand about Heraclitus as well, is that it makes him very ostensibly difficult. He's been called many things, the dark or the shadowy one, the obscure. There's another epithet attributed to him, the weeping one, which, I mean, you have to understand that one. You have to understand it in relation to Democritus, who is called the laughing one. Heraclitus is also quite pessimistic, or at least he seems to be pessimistic about the many. Heraclitus is one of the early people who considers this category of his audience. As a consummate stylist, he has to be aware of who he's writing for, and some of the people that he's writing for are hoi polloi, the many, who do not understand most things, who do not understand anything at all. But Heraclitus, of course, has access to the truth, or he knows the truth. But in any case, the other thing I'll say about the weeping one is that I think it's also a caricature of his whole everything flows thing. you know, he's got rivers running down his face. But in any case,
well, what, you know what, you're kind of hinting at that. Why don't we talk a little bit about kind of his backstory briefly, and then also too, like the sort of historical understanding of him post his death and you know, that because that becomes really important, because as you kind of hinted, like the flowing one, like there's a little bit we know about Heraclitus, who he was as a person. We have his fragments, but then there's this, like all the pre-Socratics we've covered, but especially with Heraclitus, there becomes then this like whole school built off of him. In some ways, he's most similar to people we've covered so far to Pythagoras. Like obviously we have more like direct work, but like Heraclitus obviously did become quite popular after his death. He had followers. There were people who were kind of considered themselves Heraclitians. But the way they construed him, you know, as we've kind of come to learn upon reflection and upon interpretation of our own through the, you know, not literally you and I, but, you know, over the history of academic study, really painting quite a simplified picture of him.
And it makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, you have this obscure thinker, this difficult thinker who is demanding a lot from you. He's not just going to give you the truth. You need to read it and you need to think about what Heraclitus is saying and what he's pointing at. So it makes a lot of sense that maybe it's a bit ironic too, that the hoi polloi, the many, would come up with this easy picture of what Heraclitus is, which is the flow guy. He's the guy who says all things flow in Greek, panta re. Everything is in a state of flux. There is nothing that really is what it is. Everything is in motion. The air that surrounds your desk is continuous with the desk, and the desk is also moving too, because, you know, the planet is moving. Just everything is moving. Nothing is really what it is.
Yeah, things are always being broken down and turning into other stuff, and like that's just a continuous process. And you know, for you, the listener, probably all of you are familiar with the sometimes somewhat misquoted, but this is really like the kind of the keystone, the fragment. You know, you can never step into the same river twice. That's become almost like a universally known phrase for this kind of flux doctrine. It doesn't matter, you know, even if you looks like you feel like you're in the same spot, if it feels like you're in the same place, the reality is that the reality around you and yourself are from moment to moment completely different. There is never a same spot, whether that be spatially, physically, temporally. It's always changing.
Yeah. And I think that as far as the propagation of this essentially caricature of Heraclitus goes, it does come to his Heraclitean followers a little bit. But I also think that having read a bit of how Plato treats of Heraclitus, you really do get the panta re picture of Heraclitus when you are talking with him, such as in the Theaetetus, a flux thesis is raised and defended, and it gets alluded to that it's Pythagoras. They don't use his, or not Pythagoras, Heraclitus. It's not, they don't use Heraclitus's name, but they talk about Ephesus, which is where Heraclitus is from. And they talk about how, and this is one of the reasons I do think that Heraclitus wrote aphorisms. Plato talks about how there are these people in Ephesus who draw little arrows from their quivers and shoot them out, you know, these little quips. I should say too that as far as Plato's relation to Heraclitus, I think that if Plato has an understanding of Heraclitus as a caricature, that seems to be that would make sense to me, because Aristotle reports that in his youth Plato himself was actually a Heraclitean. He believed this stuff. So he might have taken on that caricature and really thought that this is what Heraclitus thought, and then later on propagates it in his own writing. But obviously he has a response to the flux thesis, which as we go reading into this, as we look into the fragments themselves, we've been calling it a caricature because I don't actually think this is precisely what Heraclitus means by saying things like you can never step into the same river twice. I mean, he's less the flux guy and more the riddle guy, but also the fire guy if you're looking to complete your Ionian four elements collection.
I was going to say, I think there's a few things. One, there's a lot of different ways to approach him. And one is like the Ionian, you know, elements guy, right? Like he picks fire, which, you know, to me has always come across like that's very much a hearkening to a kind of tradition that he would have been steeped in very early philosophy, where everyone kind of had to, you know, exist in this pseudo like avatar-esque world, where, you know, everyone's got to have like, you got to have wind guy, you gotta have water guy, got to have earth guy. There's like guy who's like, oh, I'm going to be nothing guy.
Mm-hmm. You have to have your brand. And, it's branding. Yeah, it's ancient branding.
And then he's like fire. But I'm always like, in reading Heraclitus, and I'm by no means an expert, but I've always been felt that like Heraclitus's choice of fire was more, perhaps, I don't want to say completely metaphorical, but more literary and abstract than the other ones, in terms of not like there's a lot more like proto, like earth science going on with some of our earlier people who are literally like, oh, you know, you see like water's the basic stuff of everything. It actually is water. With Heraclitus, it's always been my suspicion that it's not quite, it has more to do with this, not the flux doctrine, because that's, I don't believe the flux doctrine is correct at all. The flux doctrine being the doctrine of like continuous change. But this kind of, that fire is very representative and works as a kind of shifting, a kind of tension, and as we'll see in Heraclitus, a kind of aptitude towards violence, if you could call it that, like a kind of interest in destruction and the regeneration that destruction brings. And that's why I've always, in my readings of Heraclitus, and we'll get into it, but I've always had him more of like the tension guy, that the unit, and that's what makes him really, to me, so we're really taking this leap and makes him genuinely one of the most, probably one of the most interesting philosophers, and particularly metaphysicians of all time, because he really is one of the first people, and in some ways one of the most articulate people, to go at this notion that like, no, we're not really so focused on like some finding some base element. It's more understanding the fundamental character of reality. And that character, I don't mean characters in like a personhood, but I mean like how like we're kind of getting into discussions which we call more ontological, right? We're getting into discussions of being, the fundamental principles of reality. And Heraclitus is someone who really points out and emphasizes that there's this deep tension in both things being and not being, and that process of change between them. And that is a very, or like not even necessarily change, but this tension between them. And that is in many ways is a much more, I think, sophisticated system or realization than the people we've covered so far.
I think the word sophisticated is a good word for that, especially considering that not only is he sort of recognizing that, well, he's in a, to use a, you know, contemporary word, he's kind of problematizing being for a moment. He's saying we have these things out there. How do we explain the plurality of these things? How do we explain that? How do we explain how one thing is one thing and not this other thing, right? Like, this is exactly what the problem with the flux thesis is it's kind of reductive. It just says all stuff flows. It's all kind of the same thing. I mean, Heraclitus does say, you know, listening not to me, but to the Logos, it is wise to agree all things are one. So he does have, he is one of the first like explicit monists, but at the same time, his monism is not one that reduces all things to a simple flow or like a Parmenidean being, which we'll get into in a later episode. But in any case, he is trying to talk about what constitutes the being of this particular being. It's all the same stuff that maintains the individuality of things. It's this kind of tension. It is this constitutive conflict, this strife that maintains the constitution of any given thing. it's paradoxical because they're all constituted by the same thing, and yet it explains the plurality of the world, which is why I think you're right to say that he's the tension guy. But at the same time, all these tensions lead to certain paradoxes, which is why I think tension guy, paradox guy, it's similar as well. They're a similar thing. So we're already at this point of kind of scraping away the flux thesis and still kind of maintaining what the flux thesis finds interesting. There is something interesting about saying, okay, things are in a state of flow and whatnot. It's just a bit reductive is all. And when we restore this idea of constitutive tensions, this is when we start to get closer to, I think, what Heraclitus was actually talking about.
Now, for our listeners, I was just thinking, because I have a feeling we're going to get into some interesting fragments, but you brought up a term that I think is really interesting and important for Heraclitus. Well, there's actually two, for both Heraclitus and for our next Parmenides. What do you mean when you say monism, just in case nobody knows or someone doesn't understand?
Yeah, no, that's
kind of important now.
No, it's a good question. And especially at this point in pre-Socratic philosophy, monism is going to become pretty important. So by monism, I mean essentially that all things at rock bottom are one single thing. So you could think of previous pre-Socratic thinkers as being monists. So Thales says all things are water, or, you know, Anaximenes says all things are air, or Anaximander says all things are apeiron, or the boundless, or whatnot. They're all saying that fundamentally at rock bottom, what you are pointing to when you are pointing to what stuff is just one thing. Like, it's not as if, you know, later on we would say, you know, a human being is body and mind. They're constituted by these two things that come together and form and make some one thing. When we say that a philosopher has a monistic metaphysics or a monistic conception of the universe, they ultimately think that undergirding the apparent plurality of the world, there is just one thing that constitutes that plurality. Or in some cases, in the case of Heraclitus, I think it's a monism constituting the plurality. You know, your monism may vary. Parmenides would say that really, since it is one thing, there is no plurality. But in Heraclitus, we have an interesting, again, paradox of how do we have a monistic universe where underneath all of it is just strife and war, and yet it's not reducible to that. There are rivers that you can fail to step into twice.
I always find myself a little bit partial to monism. I think it's an enticing argument at the most ground metaphysical level. But to use an example from like myself, my own experience, I'm going to very briefly jump to the early modern period, but this was when I first kind of countered it through reading my own thinking, as I was actually being a nerd and reading Kant in a park years and years ago. Now, Kant is not, we're not getting into monism within the context of Kant. Within that context of reading, I started to think about what we call like the phenomenal world, basically the world of my experience. As I looked out in the park, I saw like a path and, you know, like a grass pasture and a tree and all this kind of stuff. The thought that I had in my reading was basically like, it seems most likely that it's myself that is differentiating the fact that there is this thing that's a path, grass, tree, that are separate entities, right? Like, that are like I just take for granted that those things are different things from each other. But like, it's entirely possible that that's me processing the world around me, and that like that at on some more bare level, like without the observer, there isn't really this separation in the same kind of way.
Logos is a very rich word, not just philosophically for Heraclitus, but just purely linguistically for the ancient Greek world. I mean, logos can mean word, it can mean an account. So all the pre-Socratics have been trying to give an account of the world. It can also mean proportion. So when something is logos, it's in a proportion to something. This is what the Pythagoreans have been sort of exploiting and using the word for. That they use the word harmonia, which interestingly enough, Heraclitus also will use. We'll get to a fragment where he uses that later. Logos is, in this case, an account of the universe or of the cosmos or of nature itself. Logos, especially here, it's really interesting. So we've been talking about with the pre-Socratics how they're all giving this account, this logos of the Arche. Now, it's a bit anachronistic to talk about how the Milesians, you know, they give an elemental Arche or something like that. Or Xenophanes says that the Arche is, you know, the god or something. Or the Pythagoreans that the Arche are numbers. These are anachronistic. We don't have any fragments or testimony where they actually say the Arche or the principle or some sort of philosophical object that explains what the universe is any given thing. Here with Heraclitus, he's not just saying the world is fire or the world is all one. He's actually giving us that abstract philosophical tool, the logos, to say or explain what the universe is. We actually get, for the first time, something like an underlying pattern or proportion or substrate or account of how the universe works. So the logos is that the universe has something that can explain it. The words we use, the intelligibility and the proportion of it. Now, again, the Pythagoreans have been doing that as well. They talk about harmonia and they observe proportionate relations. But Heraclitus is giving us this philosophical, just to say it's philosophical is to say it's generalizable as well, right? So you can have an account of nature. You can have an account of the universe and whatnot. And the other thing, too, I should say, there's a specific fragment. I already quoted it. Listening not to me, but to the Logos, it is wise to agree that all things are one. The Logos is independent of any given thinker. Again, a bit anachronistic, but it's objective, not subjective. It's not just what Heraclitus says. There is actually some independent thing that explains, if you just listen to it, how all things are one, or you are wise to listen to it.
We're probably not going to read everything that we have in our text just because there's too much. Not that there's like a huge amount of Heraclitean surviving fragments, but there's enough that it's more than we could cover in this episode. Unlike a lot of the other things we've covered so far, who literally have like six or seven pieces, like sentences left over. The other thing too that's worth noting is that, as you pointed out earlier on, these were kind of gathered up through quotations and surviving texts and stuff like that over centuries. The order and categories that they're put in are later constructs. We just don't actually know how, like, the structure of Heraclitus's book. A lot of scholars have put a lot of effort into, you know, kind of trying to figure out what they think it's most likely would be structured as. But at the end of the day, like, there is just a lot of, and we'll talk about, and this is something that's clear and interesting from Heraclitus, is, you know, there is this sort of resonance between a lot of the fragments. Like, they really do kind of reflect on each other and signify and point to similar ideas. They're organized in such a way that it's meant to kind of really elucidate and go over and reinterpret over and over again.
He is responding to the intellectual climate at his time, but at the same time, fortunately, some of the redundancy in the way that it is written allows for non-linear readings, which is really fortunate for us because we don't have the linear order of them at all.
No, we don't. So we're just going to go off the best we have. Do you want me to start off?
Sure, yeah. You start us off where you'd like, and then we'll go from there.
I'll start off with just, this is a fragment that's actually talking about his book, which we're covering. He wrote a book on nature. This fragment, so this Heraclitus, by the way, did not write this. This is a later fragment discussing.
This is Testimonia, yeah.
Testimonia, exactly. The book said to be his is called On Nature. From its chief content, and is divided into three discourses, on the universe, politics, and theology. He dedicated it and placed it in the temple of Artemis, as some say, having purposefully written it rather obscurely, so that only those of rank and influence should have access to it. And it should not be easily despised by the populace. The work has so great a reputation that it arose from its disciples. those who are called the Heracliteans. One thing I think we kind of missed on